Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. You know, it's probably a little weird to call a cuisine the next big thing, which is what a lot of food writers have been saying about Filipino food. I think it's weird because, you know, of course, it's always been a big thing for the people who eat it and cook it, but there is something happening with Filipino food in America right now. It's a cuisine that's mostly been cooked in homes and neighborhood restaurants in Filipino communities, but as those communities have migrated through the country, and as a new generation of chefs have started to spread the good word of young coconut pastries and roast chicken stuffed with sausages and eggs, more and more people are getting hungry for dishes like buko pie and chicken relleno. So this week, we're all about diving into this fascinating, delicious food. And so we start with Amy Besa. She's a restaurateur in New York City and the award-winning author of Memories of Philippine Kitchens. She's been called the godmother of Filipino food in America, and she's with us to start our show with a kind of overview of the cuisine, where it comes from, how it evolves, and why Spam is such a big deal. Amy, so great to have you here.
Well, thank you, Francis.
So to help people understand, the wide world of Filipino food, you've come up with a pretty clear framework. You divide the food into two sections, basically. One is what you call food that was always ours, and the other is what you call food we borrowed and made our own, which I love. I love that idea and that framework. But let's start with the first category. Can you tell us what are some of the original Filipino dishes and how we can still see their mark on Filipino cuisine today?
Well, there are three dishes which are actually cooking methods. And they are the adobo, sinigang, and kinilaw. Kinilaw is, I hate to say this, but it's like our version of ceviche. And then the sinigang is a sour broth, soured by citruses and sour fruits. And then the adobo, it has a Spanish name, but as the American food scholar Ray Sokolov said, he looked at all the adobos in the Latin hemisphere and we're the only ones that braise our adobos with vinegar. And when I traveled all over the Philippines, I found these three dishes. And what is great is that they are eaten from the richest to the poorest people. That's why I call them our foods that were always ours. And they are united by sourness. And that's why I know they belong to us.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because in a place as hot and as sunny and as tropical as the Philippines, you have lots of native citrus, as you say, but anything with sugar, any fruit or anything like that, will ferment pretty quickly, right? So you have all these vinegars that are just sort of natural to
you
the place.
You can make vinegar out of anything. You know, I always define Filipino food as everything that grows in our environment and what people do to it to eat and to survive. That's the food that was always ours.
Yeah.
And then the food that was borrowed, well, you cannot escape the fact that outside food will always come in. And when I was doing my research, one of my go-to books is Katie Achaya's Handbook of Indian Food. Because one of our Filipino historians told me, we were Hinduized first before anything. That's why we have a lot of Sanskrit in all our languages. So I was going through that book, and then I saw the word Ashoka. And I said, oh my God, because in our language, in Tagalog, suka means vinegar. So anything, any word, any name that can go back to Sanskrit is a very old ingredient. So, you know, we have a lot of coconuts in the Philippines, and the sap once you draw that out, within minutes, that will ferment. Oh, wow. So it's spontaneous fermentation. What a lot of our food is right now is actually pre-refrigeration.
Yeah.
So we do eat a lot of dried meats, dried fish, salted fish, fish sauce, bagong, a lot of fermented things.
Yeah. And so like a dish like adobo, which yes. is meats, or I often see it as chicken, but it can be pork, it can be fish.
Anything.
Right? So it's interesting to me because when I see recipes for adobo, sometimes it's a mixture of soy sauce and vinegar, and sometimes it's almost like 1-to-1, and I think, man, that's a lot of vinegar. But every time I've had it, you can taste the sourness, but it's always really balanced.
Yes. You know, soy sauce is really not the original ingredient for adobo. That's a Chinese influence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a balance and harmony between salt and vinegar and the protein. And soy sauce just came later.
So the Philippines was colonized by the Spanish in the 1500s. And at the same time, there was a big rise in Chinese traders who were moving there. So what are some of the dishes that we can still see today that show the influence of Chinese traders and of the Spanish colonists?
Well, we have pancit luglug and lumpia Shanghai, pancit Canton. All of those are noodles and spring rolls. And yet, even though it's called lumpia Shanghai, if you go to Shanghai, you will never see that. You know, pancit Canton, it's not from Canton. It's not Cantonese. It's really Filipino.
Yeah. What are in those dishes?
Well, they're all like cabbage and shrimps and all kinds of toppings, which they call sahog. And then they mix it with different types of noodles. You know, we have bihon, which is rice noodle, and egg noodle.
Yeah. And what are some dishes that show the Spanish influence?
Well, there, you know, we have the afritada and the morcones, the embutidos, mm-hmm. you know, all the stuffed dishes,
yeah.
like rellenong manok, which is stuffed chicken.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dishes that have like tomato sauce in it mm-hmm. and olive oil. So that's very Spanish. But those are very expensive ingredients. So they are considered fiesta fare, like the food of the rich
yeah.
and the elite.
Yeah. And know? even your use of that word, oh, that's fiesta fare. Like
yes.
that's the Spanish word for party, which has been taken yeah. by Filipinos.
Yeah.
You know, I read something really super interesting in your book, which is something that I never thought about. But you mentioned that when the Philippines were a Spanish colony, it was run out of actually the Spanish colony in Mexico.
Yes.
And so there's a huge Mexican influence in Filipino food,
yes.
which I think is totally interesting and I'd never heard of. You mentioned dishes like chicken pipián, pipián is a Mexican dish, a stew of pumpkin seed sauce. And you say there's a Filipino version of that. And tamales, can you describe some of those Filipino dishes?
Well, the tamales is a very interesting dish that came over, but Filipinos have indigenized it. Mm-hmm. And instead of cornmeal
yeah.
wrapped in corn husk, we usually use ground rice and wrapped in banana leaves, right? But you know, the Mexican aspect of our culture is quite hidden. Most of the Mexican influences that I knew were from the fruits and the vegetables that came in.
Mm-hmm.
The first settlers, when the Spanish started to colonize the Philippines, they were all Mexicans, actually Spanish, who were already settled in Mexico. So when they came, the Spanish that they spoke were Mexican Spanish.
Oh, interesting.
And we have a lot of Nahuatl words in our language.
Oh, wow.
Well, nanay and tatay, which means mother and father, is Nahuatl.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's deep. If you get to the names for mother and father, that's
exactly.
a really deep influence.
The Nahuatl terms are nana and tata.
Oh, wow. And let's move a little forward in history to the early 20th century, where the United States colonized the Philippines for almost 50 years,
yes.
right? And right up until, I believe, around the time of World War II.
Yeah.
Talk about that influence. How do you see that influence in the food today?
Well, the first thing that the Americans did was to prove to the Filipinos that our diet of rice and fish was inadequate.
Hmm.
And so they started bringing in, we were a good market for American products. Huh. If you look at what was happening in the United States at that time, canned goods and a lot of like evaporated milk and all that, like skim milk.
And canned meat and corned beef in a can. And
all of those were brought to the Philippines because, you know, there's something about what the Americans produce. They do know how to capture your taste buds, right? I mean, I remember the first time I tasted Spam, I thought it was... this is heaven.
Yes, Spam is delicious.
How
man.
Can anyone invent something like this? And I got so addicted to it. Like, I would look forward to that for breakfast, you know, at the university. For me, one of the most obvious indigenized American product is the buko pie. You know, it's the young coconut pie.
Hmm. Describe it for us.
Well, it's a pie. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And Americans are all about pies, right? The double-crusted pie. But then we filled it with young coconut. And it is such a classic.
Yeah.
And people really think of it as Filipino.
Yeah.
And then also a lot of chiffon cakes are everywhere. Even the Chinese stores make chiffon cakes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the influence of the United States.
That's
but...
good.
Whenever people say, well, you know, our food is getting lost, all these influences from fast food, I never get worried because we are a people that know how to preserve our food and embrace foreign foods at the same time.
That's great. Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I always love to speak about Filipino food.
Amy Besa is the author of the award-winning Memories of Philippine Kitchens. You can find her recipe for crispy shrimp and vegetable fritters, called ukoy, at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we'll visit with Chef King Fujanikong and his mother Emma in her home kitchen to make sinigang, the classic Filipino sour soup. And we'll get a lesson on how to stock a Filipino pantry. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. A couple of years ago, I was writing a story about the Filipino community in New York City, and I had the pleasure of meeting Emma Fujanikong. She grew up an orphan in the Philippines, became a nurse, came to the U.S., saved a bunch of lives, and made a life for herself, too. And she's a lovely home cook, and she's also the mother of a terrific chef, her son, King. So when we started planning the show, we wanted to get at the food that Filipinos cook at home. And one of the easiest and most delicious is a savory and sour soup called sinigang. And Emma and King agreed to teach us how to make it. So I got to go back to Emma's New York apartment in late summer, which means we were sweating like we were in Manila, and the windows were open and the sounds of city wildlife were part of the ambiance. Let's dig in. King, great to see you again.
You too, Francis.
And Emma, thank you for having me back in your wonderful home.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So today, you're going to show me how to make sinigang, which is an indigenous native Filipino dish.
It's a kind of, we'll make a seafood sour soup out of shrimps and salmon head and neck. It's a typical dish, but it's regional the way they make it sour. They use tamarind, they use guava, they call batuan, and sometimes calamansi and vegetable.
Yeah. So calamansi is the lime-like fruit, guava.
Mm-hmm.
And King, when you emailed about this, you said this is absolutely one of your comfort food dishes growing up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My mom, she used to cook it here, at least once a week. It's a soup that we had. And not always with seafood. You know, a lot of times we'll have it with pork, even beef, ribs. But what I really loved about it, I remember, is, you just get a hot bowl of rice and you put the soup on the rice. And that sourness just keeps wanting you to go back and have more and more. Like, you never have enough.
Yeah. So let's do it. Let's start with your tamarind sinigang.
Yeah, let's start cooking.
So you have this water that's a little bit white, a little bit milky. So this is water that you use to wash the rice. And you save that
washing.
Water.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you wash the rice, I guess some of the starch comes off of the rice. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a cloudy water. And when you use it in the soup, it's going to add a little body to it. I mean, you can see it now already.
Yeah.
And then the tamarind, you know, we don't get tamarind pods here. So we buy the blocks of tamarind. Mm-hmm. And the blocks of tamarind, all you have to do is kind of just put it in warm water. And it softens up. And then you could pull out the seeds and like the string in there. I mean, it says seedless, but I've never really seen it. That's seedless.
If it says seedless, yeah. It's a total lie. Because yeah. The whole thing is basically a mashed seeds. Block of seeds yeah, and seeds shells like, and yeah. Pods and all that. Uh-huh. So you take that block and you put it in this water. Mm-hmm. You heat it up so it softens. And then you kind of strain out the seeds and kind of push it through a sieve or something. Yeah. So, Emma, you have basically a little tea strainer that you're using.
Yeah, I usually have a big one.
So it's not traditional to use a 2-inch strainer.
Actually, I use kind of a cheesecloth when I used to work in OR. We called it a lap pad.
Uh-huh. One of my favorite things about your cooking, so Emma was a nurse for many years, and one of my favorite things about her cooking is her creative and inventive use of OR materials in her kitchen, including using a scalpel to debone a chicken.
To debone the chicken,
and
right.
And the sutures to sew it up. I forgot how low your burners are.
King is used to his restaurant stove, so he's always a little disappointed when he comes and cooks on mom's home burners.
When it comes to a boil, we add the tomato and the onion.
So thank you for doing all the work in advance, but it's very simple, it looks like. You have some limes cut up, you have a few tomato wedges cut up, you have some daikon radish, some onion slice, some long beans, but it seems, there's a fair number of ingredients, but it seems a pretty simple setup. We're not doing any complicated technique or anything. We're just waiting for this to boil and then adding all the vegetables.
And then shrimps and salmon head comes last.
And with salmon too, it's that really rich, oily fish, so you get a lot of that richness to balance with the sour broth. All right, so in goes the tomatoes. Now our onions.
And then the onions.
And now with the peppers too, you have an option, like at the restaurant, I'll usually cut them up. It'll add a little more spice to it. But you can leave them whole as well. And then it's not as spicy until you break it open.
Right. So at this point, broth is starting to come up. It's at a nice simmer. You put in some onions and some tomato first.
Mm-hmm. Salt and pepper.
I'm going to put some calamansi in there too, okay?
So now there are three kinds of sour flavor in here between the tamarind, the tomato, and the calamansi.
We add fish sauce.
Oh, you like fish sauce in this?
A tablespoon. It makes it tasty. Back home, they use MSG, but it's not healthy. So this is a better and more natural version.
Yeah, fish sauce gives it so much umami and depth, and especially with sour things, fish sauce is so delicious.
What do you want to add next, Molly? You want to add the daikon?
No, the sitao. Okay. So this is the native string beans, we call it sitao. This is harder to cook than the radish.
Yeah.
So I put it first.
So you have these long beans, you cut them into like 4-inch lengths. Mm-hmm. So a couple grinds of pepper, some salt. And at this point, you just wait for the vegetables in stages, right? So when the long beans are starting to get tender, you'll add the next thing, you'll add the next thing like that. King is looking for that sour hit. So he's just like sneaking more tamarind into the pot. So Emma, what's it like having a chef for a son when he comes and he grew up on your food, but now he comes and keeps messing with it.
I love it because he really can cook.
Oh yeah. I mean, King's a great cook, but do you ever feel a little bit like, I taught you how to do this. You can't come into my kitchen and mess my things up.
Well, yes, but this mommy, this is the way I do it. Is that okay?
Now King just skimmed some of the foam off the top, which is such a chefy thing, and which I'm sure your mother would never do, and your mother's aunt would never do.
We add the radish.
You don't have to add all of them. That's a lot of radish. Oh.
Okay.
And now we just added these beautiful half moons of daikon radish. I love daikon, but it's also interesting too, because when you cut into it, it's so hard.
It is.
But it cooks really fast. Mm-hmm. It gets really tender, and it really absorbs the flavor of the liquid. And
it does,
has a little bit of its own sort of like sweet bitterness, almost like a melon kind of flavor. Mm-hmm. It's such a cool ingredient.
Better, right?
Yeah.
Nothing is forcing the mother to agree that he did it better than she does.
So what's next, Ma? You want to put the peppers and
the peppers last time.
Okay, and then the fish and the shrimp.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah.
So after the.
After the radish.
After the daikon simmered for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Inga, the shrimp, and you like the shrimp shells on
shells
heads on.
Shells and everything, yeah. Again, it adds umami to the soup.
Yeah.
Then you add fish head.
Yeah.
You can make the whole salmon, but it's not as tasty as the head or the neck, you know. Again, the bone from the fish adds umami, you know, adds flavor, and it's really very good.
And you're sort of gently laying these salmon necks and salmon collars and heads on top of the broth.
Uh-huh.
And you just have them lightly poaching, and now we just covered it just to get them
just
cooked.
Yeah, just wait till they boil.
So you came here in 1963 to New York City, uh-huh. and at that time there were a lot of nurses coming from the Philippines,
right.
and so you came among that group and really changed this neighborhood because there were so many Filipino nurses who lived here.
Nurses around here.
Yeah.
It used to be even the doctors come from abroad, India, Persia, you know.
And here we are, we're like in around 14th Street on the east side of Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And because there are 5 or 6 hospitals right nearby, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was a huge community of
right.
all these international
And they call it the Bedpan
workers.
Alley, you know.
So what do they call it?
Bedpan Alley.
Yeah.
From 14th Street up to 34th Street. It's all hospitals, you know.
All right, so now you're just spooting the broth back over the fish just to make sure it's getting heat on both sides.
Yeah.
Looks good, Ma.
Okay, so
looking good.
Taste it.
It's looking good.
Enough
looking
salt.
Very good. Little more salt, but it's good.
Salt and the taste?
Yeah.
King's sneaking more tamarind back in the pot.
I like it too.
Oh, yeah. Check it out, friends. Let's try it.
It smells so good. Oh, it's so good. It's light, it tastes like food you want to eat all day long, and you have like the shrimp and the fish that's sort of in the background a little bit now.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're sort of the base, but you get so much of that that fruitiness from the tamarind. And that's so delicious. Thank you two so much for having me back.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for coming back. I'm glad you like the sinigang.
Yeah, I'm gonna take it with me, I'm sorry.
Now you see why it was one of my favorite dishes growing up, right?
Totally.
I'm glad you could come and taste our delicious food from the Philippines.
That was Emma Fajanakong and her son, King. He's the chef of Kuma Inn in New York City, and you can find their recipe for sinigang, as well as a video we shot with them at splendidtable.org. And be sure to download our podcast, where King teaches us to make another Filipino classic, pancit canton. It's this super savory stir-fried noodle with chicken and sweet Chinese sausage. It's terrific, and you'll find that wherever you get your podcasts. One of the beauties of cooking Filipino food in America is that, for all their amazing tropical ingredients, the basic pantry is really pretty straightforward, and you can find most of what you need in a standard supermarket. But if you can get to a Filipino or Asian market, there are some delicious things you'll really want to look out for. Chef Chad Valencia of Lhasa in Los Angeles is here to tell us what we need. All right, Chef, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So I want to talk to you today about the Filipino pantry and what are some of the basic seasonings or flavorings that we should have if we're going to start cooking this food. But before we get there, can you tell me what you think Filipino food tastes like?
High acid, bright, funk forward, meat heavy, and then also very seafood heavy. So yeah, fat, salt, acid, funk, that's Filipino food.
Cool, so let's go to the grocery store. Fill my cart, tell me what I need to buy.
I would definitely start with something as simple as ginger. Grab some sugarcane vinegar, some patis, which is fish sauce, some bagoong, which is some shrimp paste, calamansi juice. That's a tiny citrus fruit the size of maybe a kumquat and a key lime mixed. And you're lucky to find it fresh. It does exist here in California. You could definitely find it frozen in Filipino markets and then also bottled fresh or pasteurized, I should say. And the flavor is so distinct that it's better off finding those than trying to substitute it with anything else. And some coconut milk, if they have it. If you're lucky, there's a condiment called achara, which is a sweet pickle that's often eaten with grilled meats and kind of fatty things.
Right away, you gravitated towards the vinegar. And you said sugarcane vinegar, right?
Sugarcane vinegar, correct. Yeah, there's so many different kinds of vinegars used in Filipino food, but sugarcane vinegar, I feel, is like kind of a good introductory one. It doesn't have too much of a bite. It's balanced, really great for vinaigrettes. Or you could, we do something called sukang sili, which is spiced vinegar. So we'll take some garlic, some shallot, we'll mince that, some Thai chilies, we'll mince that, and we'll throw that in the vinegar and let it marinate, and you dip grilled meats or deep-fried snacks in there as well, even chicharron maybe.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So you mentioned fish sauce, which, you know, I think a lot of us know about, but tell me about the bagoong, the shrimp paste.
Sure. Bagoong, there are definitely two different versions of it that are commonly used. One is kind of intimidating. It's this bright pink color. It's a fermented shrimp paste. Definitely heavier on the funk aspect. And then there's one that's slightly more tamed, but definitely still funky, still umami forward. That's a salted and sauteed version of that shrimp paste. They're both really delicious. But if you are a little scared or intimidated of the pink one, the brown one will definitely do the job.
And how do you use them?
I mean, maybe think what you'd use anchovy in to get some kind of extra depth in a sauce. Kind of add funk or salt where you don't want to just add salt and you want to add a little more complexity to something. And vinaigrettes is really awesome. We like to incorporate it into some butter and melt it over a steak. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So fish sauce and coconut milk and ginger. So those are very common things.
You definitely
don't need an Asian market for in most cases at this point.
You can, right.
Lots of supermarkets will carry that stuff.
I mean, I also chose some things that will definitely go good together, like coconut milk, ginger, shrimp paste. Cook some meat in there or make a sauce, put it over some fish. It's kind of straightforward, yeah. But definitely bold flavors that are definitely very Filipino.
And so let me ask you, when I go to a Chinese market, probably the first thing I do is I go to the freezer aisle and I start scoping out all the different brands of frozen dumplings they have because they're almost always good. Like I could like close my eyes and grab a bag and I go home and boil them up and they're delicious. And maybe it's just because, you know, that's comfort food for me. But
right.
Is there a kind of equivalent where if I'm in a Filipino market, there are just going to be products that are frozen, package prepared, that like are just going to be pretty tasty?
I mean, there are definitely some very special Filipino ice creams, like corn and cheese is one. It's called queso real, and it's a cheddar, I think it's cheddar, and corn-flavored ice cream. There's probably actually corn in it.
That sounds like it could be amazing.
It is amazing, and that's definitely like street vendor-style ice cream carts all over the Philippines will have that for sure. Just in terms of convenience, there happens to be a lot of packet, ready-made spice mixes and sauces for your traditional Filipino stews and braises.
Mm-hmm.
Adobo comes in a packet, man. Like, add some water and throw some meat in there and you're good. You know what I mean? Have that over rice. Definitely comfort thing for me, too. I think just in the day-to-day, I think Filipinos have gotten used to the convenience aspect of preparing all these old-school meals, you know, and a lot of the traditional ingredients may not be around, so these packets exist. And I can't knock them. We grew up eating them, you know?
Yeah.
They're delicious.
Right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chef.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Chad Valencia is the chef and co-owner, with his brother Chase, of the restaurant Lasa in Los Angeles. That word, Lasa, by the way, is Tagalog for taste. One thing that we keep hearing again and again this hour is how Filipino food is this delicious mix of cultures. But cultures sometimes have a way of mixing uneasily. Imagine a big family with relatives from different cultures and classes visiting from all over the world. and they're coming to a country where people are so into Christmas, they start decorating in September. Well, all that makes for some pretty intense and complicated holiday dinners. That's the slice of life the artist and writer Jessica Hagedorn brings us now.
When my father's mother, Socorro Bertierra Gonzaga, visits us all the way from Spain during the crazy Christmas holidays, we children have to be on our best behavior. We call her Abuelita. She is a widow like my mother's mother, Narcisa Divino Logan, whom we address as Lola. My parents host bienvenida parties in Abuelita's honor, and the entire Gonzaga clan in Manila attends. Uncle Agustin and Tita Florence, my favorite cousin Pucha and her brother Mikey, my antisocial Uncle Esteban and Tita Menchu with their grown-up sons, my cousins Eddie, Ricky, and Claudio, who we call Ding Ding, plus Eddie's wife, Nana. Nana smokes too many cigarettes, is painfully thin, and is considered one of the best-dressed women in Manila. Nana survives on a diet of ice cream and true colas, which she consumes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Cousin Ding Ding is in his early 20s. He always comes alone to our parties and leaves early. He adores my mother and entertains her with obscene jokes. My father avoids him. Everyone in the family suspects Ding Ding likes boys. No one discusses it openly. My relatives make me sick sometimes, kissing and fawning over Abuelita Socorro like they do. Tita Florence and Uncle Agustin think that Abuelita Socorro will die soon and leave them her sizable fortune. My mother, who's the only one who treats her like a regular person, says none of it matters. At our lavish Christmas parties, our amazing cook, Pasita, creates sumptuous feasts under my mother's direction. Abuelita prefers rich foods covered with creamy sauces. She loathes vegetables and fruits of any kind and never eats anything raw or green. I feel like a conejo, she says, waving away the bowl of salad which our servant, Ida, offers to her. All that lettuce gets stuck in my throat. Abuelita Socorro makes the sign of the cross, makes clucking sounds with her tongue at her own revelation. Everyone at her guest of honor's table, that's decorated with a red tablecloth and a miniature Christmas tree centerpiece of blue tulle sprinkled with fake snow, falls silent. My abuelita seldom speaks, and when she does, it's usually in lisping Castilian Spanish, which my father has to translate for some of us. But this time, she has spoken in English, which sounds bizarre. My father pats her on the arm to reassure her. Enjoy yourself, Mama. Eat whatever you want, he says to Abuelita in Spanish. He and my mother are the only adults in the family who don't call her Mommy Darling. Pasita roasts baby lechon and bakes three-tiered cakes oozing custard, guava jelly, sugar, and cream. She calls them Gonzaga cakes. Pasita also makes the best leche flan in the world. Not too eggy, but firm, with a bittersweet flavor of blood orange and burnt sugar syrup as the perfect counterpoint. Abuelita Socorro practically swoons when she eats it. Leche flan's all I can stand to eat at these family fiestas. I help myself to three or four pieces, maybe more. You're insane, my cousin Pucha says, piling her plate high with thick slices of lechon meat, crispy lechon skin, and mounds of rice with lechon gravy from the decadent buffet table. Why don't you eat real food, she asks me. What Pucha doesn't know is that when all the guests have gone and only the elders of the Gonzaga clan are left on the candlelit terrace having their cigars and their coffee and their cognac, I will sneak off to that little room behind the kitchen for a secret midnight feast with my other grandmother, Lola Narcisa. She is never included in the festivities, and she never complains. We will eat with our hands. Rice, salt fish, adobong kangkong, and more leche flan.
That was Jessica Hagedorn reading from her National Book Award-nominated novel, Dog Eaters. Now she's at work adapting another novel of hers, The Gangster of Love, for the stage. It's about a Filipino family making their new life in America. Coming up, we're going to take a break from cooking, and we're going to find out where we can go out to eat Filipino food. And then we'll get back to the stove with America's Test Kitchen taking on chicken adobo. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam. So after all this talk on Filipino food, you might be in the mood to just go out and eat it. But where? Our next guest, Joanne Boston, travels the country to search out the newest and hottest chefs and revisit the classic neighborhood places. She's got the map for the most incredible culinary road trip. So hi, Joanne. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you about Filipino food across the country because, you know, there are parts of the country that we know there are big Filipino populations. And then there are, you know, there are towns and cities where I don't know that it was obvious to a lot of people. Like, for instance, one of the best meals I've ever had in my entire life was at a little tiny Filipino restaurant, not in the back of a grocery store, but in the back of the grocery store after you go down into the basement in Juneau, Alaska. And I had just tremendously delicious food there. So can you tell us where in the country do we find Filipino communities? And what are some of the places we should eat when we go to those places?
Sure. So Filipinos have been in the United States for a long time. They like to settle around water because the Philippines is an island country. So anywhere where they could get seafood, fresh vegetables is great. I'm from the Bay Area, so there's a huge population of Filipinos here. I live in Daly City, which probably has the most Filipinos outside of the Philippines. They actually call it Manila Town. I have lots of friends who are from Seattle, Washington. There's a huge community over there. Of course, there's New York City, Virginia Beach. There's a growing population over in Chicago. And there's even some in Florida and Texas. So many of them are coming into the middle of America. I have a friend who is doing pop-ups in St. Louis. Her name is Malou. And she's saying that everyone there is so welcoming and they embrace her food. And this is in the middle of America. So it's really great. But, you know, the earliest places that Filipinos came to were Hawaii.
Oh, sure. Do you find that there are regional correlations? Like, does the food, I mean, thinking greedily from my stomach's point of view, if I'm going to these communities, does the food change from community to community around the country?
I think the most obvious example would be in Hawaii, because a lot of the Filipinos came there to work on the pineapple and sugarcane fields. So the majority of the Filipinos there are from Ilocos or Ilocos Norte. Ilocos is known for their bitter flavors, lots of bitter melon, and you'll see that in Hawaii. And if you come here toward the mainland, that's when you'll see it more dispersed. When I see chefs cooking, I see a lot of them picking up influences from their parents' regions. Even though they've never lived in the Philippines, the parents and the grandparents make an effort to cook food at their homes. And so a lot of these chefs are paying homage to their grandparents and their parents.
Well, I think this is really interesting because I feel like I keep seeing lots of young Filipino-American chefs, people like Dale Talde, like Angela Di Mayuga, like Alvin Kailan and Sheldon Simeon and Chad Valencia. So many of these chefs started out cooking in restaurants, but almost none of them, to my understanding, started cooking in Filipino restaurants. And more I see them when they're striking out to open their own places, they're inspired by Filipino cuisine or the particular regional cuisine that they grew up with in their home. But, you know, but they're also adding techniques and methods and influences from the French or Italian or fine dining restaurants they came up in. Can you talk about this generation and why we seem to be seeing so many of these chefs right now in this moment?
I think I see it now, or there's like this huge attention toward Filipinos and these chefs because the media, I have to say, has a lot to do with it. They are giving more attention to the food, the people who are cooking it. And I think they feel empowered to finally cook what they grew up on. And Alvin Kailan, he's a great example.
And Alvin's restaurant is called Egg Slut.
Yeah, he's in LA. And Ruth Reichel visited his truck, blew up on social media. And now he has a location in Vegas. He's opening a restaurant in New York now. And he helped open another restaurant in LA. So I think now, since the media has put so much attention on the food, a lot of these chefs who have been in the industry for decades even have become a little more, I don't want to say unashamed, but I think that's a little part of it, because they were not sure if their food was going to fly with the mainstream community. So with Alvin Kailan being one of the biggest spearheads, including Nicole Ponseca in New York City, these chefs are saying, I'm inspired by these people. I want to do my part and I want to share my story.
All right, so let me just ask you straight up. Can you name some names? Where should we eat great Filipino food, both traditional and this new style of contemporary Filipino food?
So I could start in the Bay Area. The traditional Filipino food that I go for is from this little casino near the cemeteries in Colma called Lucky Chances. And it's 24 hours. You'll have a wide range of Filipino dishes such as sinigang, kare-kare. And what I go for are the silogs, which are the Filipino breakfast platter. It's like Filipino Denny's, where you have your starch of this really great garlic fried rice and fried eggs. And then you have your protein. And they have this list. You could have longanisa, which are the sausages. You could have tocino, sweetened cured pork. You could have spam even, fried chicken, whatever you want. You can make it into a silog. And not only is it funny because there's hundreds of people outside the doors playing poker, but the majority of the people who are there are Filipino, and the kitchen staff is Filipino. So they know what they're doing. I really like this one place in the Mission. It's actually a pop-up concept within a bar. It's called Fob Kitchen. They also do their own version of silog and traditional Filipino dishes, but they're using really great meat. It's a very approachable menu. It's delicious, and it's great with the alcoholic drinks that they serve at the bar there. In Seattle, where they have a really great, I don't even want to say it's a restaurant. It's a little tabletop restaurant called Oriental Mart. It's at Pike Place Market. It's in the back. You don't see it from the street. You actually have to maneuver your way into the back of the store. But they have the greatest salmon head sinigang. It's so comforting, especially when the weather out in Seattle gets cold and wet. It's so good.
That's so interesting. What about in the middle of the country?
In the middle of the country, I mentioned Malu. She has a pop-up called Skip to Malu. She does Kamayan. So Kamayan, I have to say, blew up in the United States over the last 2-3 years. It's a huge table, communal table, from end to end, lined with rice and fried meats, lumpia, grilled vegetables, whatever you want. You just put it on top of the rice. You get all your friends and your family to gather around this table, and you just eat with your hands.
Oh, wow.
In the Philippines, they call it Budol Fight, which was a way that all ranks of the military actually all ate together. My father, he's in the army in the Philippines, and he's actually in charge of cooking the meals. So he would show me pictures of the Budol Fight that he cooked for his brigade. And they would all come with all their guns and in their military attire, and they'd all eat together, all ranks. That was their form of community. So Malu does that in St. Louis. There are so many places around the United States to eat. In Washington, D.C., there's Bad Saint, Purple Patch, and a new one coming up called Kaliwa. In L.A., there's Lhasa, Irenia, Rice Bar. And in New York City, there's Purple Yam, Maharlika, Jeepney, Kuma Inn, and Ugly Kitchen. So there's lots of restaurants around the country.
It might be time for like a massive road trip. I'm just going to stuff myself with Filipino food all around the country. Thank you so much, Joanne.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me again.
Joanne Boston is the vice president of the nonprofit Filipino Food Movement. You can find a list of some of her favorite restaurants across the country at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with America's Test Kitchen to see what they're up to, and happily, they got the memo that we're doing a show on Filipino food. Now, chicken adobo is arguably the national dish of the Philippines, and pretty much everyone we talked to for this show brought up this savory, vinegary braise. Well, it turns out that one of ATK's cooks, Brian Roof, lived in the Philippines as a kid, and he's been chasing his memories of chicken adobo ever since. Our producer, Sally Swift, talked with Brian about this recipe.
Hey, Brian, nice to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we have been talking all hour about Filipino food, and adobo has come up time and time again. And I understand you have kind of a personal relationship with it.
Yeah. I was actually born in the Philippines and spent the first few years of my life there. We had a Filipino nanny who used to make this dish all the time. So, you know, I'm very familiar with it from my own experience and was excited to develop the recipe for it.
So tell us essentially what adobo is.
At its core, it's very basic. It's a braise of soy sauce and vinegar. Usually chicken thighs or chicken drumsticks or pork ribs or pork butt are used. There's a heavy handful of black pepper, bay leaves, and garlic thrown in. And it's just a very pungent but luscious kind of flavor.
It's absolutely delicious. So when you guys were working on the recipe, what did you, dare I ask, all you Filipino home cooks, do not write me, but dare I ask, what did you think the issues were?
Well, a lot of the recipes start off with very acidic marinade. Just, you usually use the vinegar and soy sauce, combine them, marinate the chicken, and that ends up being the sauce that you cook the chicken in. But the overly acidic marinades tend to make the chicken tough and rubbery. Mm-hmm. So we removed the vinegar from the marinade and just used soy sauce, which gave us a lot of good flavor.
And then what was the other issue for you?
Well, a lot of the braises turn out to be very salty because of the soy sauce. We tried adding water to dilute it a little bit, but then we just had no flavor whatsoever. So we kept the soy sauce, kept the vinegar in the braise, and actually went up to a restaurant in Brooklyn, New York called the Purple Yam, and meeting with the chef there, Rami Doratan, who's actually married to Amy Beso, who you spoke to earlier in the show.
It's a small world.
Yeah. And he told us about the method that he uses from the southern Luzon island of the Philippines, and that involves coconut milk. So we came back to the kitchen and added coconut milk to our braising liquid, and it was akin to adding oil to a vinaigrette. It really helped to temper some of the sharpness, but you got a lot of good flavors, a very rich, kind of luscious sauce that coated the chicken very nicely, and it was really the saving grace for our adobo.
Oh, I think coconut milk is such a great idea. So quickly, just step us through your adobo recipe.
Sure. Well, after marinating the chicken for about 30 minutes in soy sauce.
And you're using bone-in, skin-on thighs, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Bone-in, skin-on thighs, marinated for about 30 minutes in soy sauce. Mm-hmm. We take the thighs and we put them all into a skillet, a cold skillet, skin side down. And this is a technique that, you know, I was familiar with from working in restaurants and cooking duck breast, where we want to render the skin out before you proceed. So we turn the skillet on and we let the fat kind of cook out from beneath the surface of the skin, so you're not left with a very greasy sauce. So we run the chicken over medium-high heat for about 10 minutes until all the fat is rendered out. We dump the fat out of the skillet. Then we just add the soy sauce from the marinade, vinegar, coconut milk, handful of garlic, bay leaves, and black pepper. And we just let it braise. We'll flip it once throughout the cooking, but it's basically braised in about 30 minutes on the stovetop.
Wow, that is fast. This is perfect weeknight eating.
Yeah, it's perfect. And it's very flavorful, very easy. And yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Thank you so much for coming in, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Roof is the executive food editor of Cook's Country magazine. You can find that recipe for chicken adobo at splendidtable.org. Now, chicken adobo is pretty much synonymous with Filipino food, but I have to tell you, one of the first times I remember going to a Filipino restaurant, I got a less romanticized dish. In English, on the menu, it was just called pork chops with special sauce, and it turned out that the special sauce was, I'm actually pretty sure it was Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. So I admit I was kind of disappointed, but when I told someone about that years later, they said to me, well, you know that's like American Army base food, right? And then it clicked. That American influence on this cuisine that Amy Beso talked about at the top of our show. And then a few years after that, when I first interviewed Emma Fojanikong, she taught me how to make a specialty called embutido. It's this meatloaf of sausages that originally came from Spain, but now people make it with, guess what? Vienna sausages and canned ham. And she makes it as a special Christmas thing. Now, I thought it was delicious, but, you know, kind of kitschy. But what really struck me was when Emma said, when the GIs brought these canned foods to the Philippines, it meant you were someone special if they shared them with you. It became a status symbol to have Vienna sausages and Spam. And now, when I look back on it, to have a can of cream of mushroom soup that you would serve as a special sauce for guests. So now I think of that pork chop meal as a reminder that all foods are full of history, and that history is complicated, and things might not mean what you think they mean. And it's a reminder that all our foods always tell us something about who we are. Well, that's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. Obviously, we only had an hour to go into Filipino food, and we could have spent days and, well, the rest of our lives, but we hope you enjoyed it. Please join us again next week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with this line from the poet Marjorie Evasco. This must be the taste of language, the tongue mapped by many colors. SplendidTable.org is the place to get everything you need to know about the stuff you heard on the show today. Thanks to everyone in the Filipino food community for their generosity of time and spirit, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lam, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.